The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassette 8, Side 2. Next, this handful of mutineers was marched back under separate escort, or else a black maria rolled up to collect them. The herd, now purged of fermenting agents, was then brought to its feet and driven to work. Our educators had shown us whether we could ever believe anything they said. They also plucked out candidates for jail in the camp grounds while they were deserted for the day, and arrests easily flitted over that 4-meter wall which the strike had been unable to surmount, and pecked at the Ukrainian camp division. The very day before my operation was due, Yanchenko, the surgeon, was arrested and taken off to jail. Prisoners continued to be arrested or posted to other camps, it was always difficult to know which, without the precautions observed at the beginning. Small groups of 20 or 30 were sent off somewhere. Then suddenly, on February the 19th, they began assembling an enormous transport, some 700 strong. They were under special discipline. As they left the camp, they were handcuffed. Fate had exacted retribution. The Ukrainians, who had taken such good care not to help the Muscovites, were thicker on the ground in this transport than we were. True, on the point of leaving, they saluted our shattered strike. A new wood processing plant, itself oddly enough built entirely of wood, in Kazakhstan where there is no timber and lots of stone, for reasons which remained officially unexplained, but I know for certain that there was arson, burst into flame at several points simultaneously, and within 2 hours 3 million rubles had gone up in smoke. For those on their way to be shot, it was like a Viking's funeral, the old Scandinavian custom of burning the hero's boat together with his body. I was lying in the recovery room. I was alone in the ward. The camp was in such a turmoil that no one could be admitted. The hospital had come to a standstill. After my room, which was at the butt end of the hut, came the morgue, where Dr. Kornfeld's body had been lying for I don't know how many days, because no one had time to bury him. Morning and evening, a warder nearing the end of his round would stop outside, and to simplify the count, embrace my room and the morgue in one inclusive gesture. Two more here, and tick us off on his clipboard. Pavel Boronyuk, who had also been called to join the large transport, broke through all the cordons and came to embrace me before he left. Not just our camp, but the whole of creation seemed to us to be shaken, reeling before the storm. We were storm-tossed, and we could not realize that outside the camp all was as calm and stagnant as ever. We felt as though we were riding great waves on something that might sink under our feet, and that if we ever saw each other again, it would be in quite a different country. But just in case, farewell, my friend. Farewell, all my friends. That year of tedium and stupidity, my last year in Ekibastuts and the last Stalinist year on the archipelago, dragged on. After they had been kept in jail for a while, and no evidence against them found, a few, but only a few, were sent back into the camp, while many, very many, whom we had come to know and love over the years, were taken away, some for further investigation and trial, others to the isolator, because of some indelible black mark in their dossiers, although they might long since have been more like angels than prisoners. Others again, to the Jezkazgan mines. And there was even a transport of the mentally defective. Kishkin the Joker was squeezed in with this lot, and the doctors also fixed up Volodya Gershuni. To replace those who had left, the stoolies crawled one by one out of the safe deposit, timidly and apprehensively at first, then more and more brazenly. One who returned to the body of the camp was the venal bitch, Volodka Ponomarev, once a mere lathe operator, but now in charge of the parcels room. The distribution of the precious crumbs collected by destitute families was a task which the old Czechist Maximenko naturally entrusted to a notorious thief. The security officers again started summoning anyone and everyone to their offices as often as they pleased. It was an airless spring. Anyone whose horns or ears stuck out too much quickly learned to keep his head down. I did not go back to my foreman's job, there were now plenty of foremen again, but became a smelter's mate in the foundry. We had to work hard that year, for reasons which I shall explain. the one and only concession which the administration made when all our hopes and demands lay in ruins, was to make us self-financing. Under this system, what we produced did not simply vanish into the maw of Gulag, but was priced, and 45% of its value was counted as our earnings. The rest went to the state. Of these earnings, the camp appropriated 70% for the maintenance of guards, dogs, barbed wire, the camp jail, security officers, the officers responsible for discipline, for censorship, for education, in a word, all the things without which our lives would be unlivable. But the remaining 30%, 13.5% of the whole product, was credited to the personal account of the prisoner, and part of this money, though not all of it, provided you had not misbehaved, not been late, not been rude, not been a disappointment to your bosses, you could, on application once a month, convert into a new camp currency, vouchers, and these vouchers you could spend. The system was so contrived that the more sweat you lost, the more blood you gave, the closer you came to that 30%. But if you didn't feel like breaking your back, all your labour went to the camp, and you got zero. And the majority, ah, what a part the majority plays in our history, especially when it is carefully prepared by weeding, gratefully gulped down this sop from its bosses and risked working itself to death to buy condensed milk, margarine, and nasty sweets at the food counter, or get itself a second supper in the commercial dining room. And since worksheets were made up for the team as a whole, not for individual members, all those who didn't want to sacrifice their health for margarine still had to do it, so that their comrades could earn more. They also started bringing films to the camp much more frequently than before. As is always the case in the camps, or in villages, or in remote workers' settlements, no one had enough respect for the spectators to announce the titles in advance. A pig, after all, is not informed in advance what is going to be poured into his trough. Nonetheless, the prisoners, could they be the same prisoners who had kept up the hunger strike so heroically that winter? Now flocked in, grabbed seats an hour before the windows were draped, without worrying one little bit whether the film was worth it. Bread and circuses, such a cliché that it's embarrassing to repeat it. No one could blame people for wanting to eat their fill after so many years of hunger, but while we were there filling our bellies, comrades of ours, some who had taught us to fight, some who had shouted, "No surrender," to their hutmates in those January days, and some who had not been involved at all, were at that moment on trial somewhere. Comrades of ours were being shot or carried off to begin new sentences in isolation camps, or broken by interrogation after interrogation, bundled into cells where condemned men had scratched a forest of crosses on the walls, and the snake of a major looked in to smile a promise. "Ah, Panin, I remember you. Oh, yes, I remember you. The wheels are turning, don't worry. We'll soon process you." A fine word, that, process. You can process a man for the next world, process a man into the cooler for 24 hours. And a chit for a pair of second-hand trousers may also be processed. But the door slams shut, the snake is gone, smiling enigmatically, leaving you to guess, to spend a month without sleep, to beat your head against the stones, wondering how exactly they intend to process you. Talking about it is easy enough. Suddenly, in Ekibastutz, they got together another party of 20 men for transportation. Rather a strange party. They were gathered unhurriedly, they were not treated harshly, they were not isolated. It was almost as though they were being assembled for release. Not one of them, however, was anywhere near the end of his sentence, nor were there any of those hard-boiled zecks among them whom the bosses try to break with spells in the cooler and special punishments. No, they were all good prisoners, in good standing with their superiors. There, once again, was the slippery and self-assured foreman of the vehicle repair shop, Mikhail Mikhailovich Generalov, the crafty simpleton Belousov, a foreman machinist, the engineer and technician Gultyayev, the Moscow designer Leonid Rykov, a grave and steady man with the face of a statesman, the very amiable, universally friendly Zhenka Milyukov, a lathe operator with a pert pancake face, and another lathe operator, the Georgian Koki Kocherova, a great lover of truth, hot in defense of justice when the crowd was looking. Where were they going? From the party's composition, obviously not to a maximum punishment prison. "Must be a nice place you're going to," they were told. "They'll be taking the guards off you." But not one of them showed a glimmer of happiness, not for a single moment. They wagged their heads miserably, reluctantly gathered their belongings, in two minds as to whether to take them or leave them. They looked like beaten curs. Could they really have grown so fond of turbulent ekibastuts? They even said goodbye with lips that seemed numb and unconvincing intonations. They were taken away. We were not given time to forget them. 3 weeks later, the word went around. They'd been brought back. Back here? Yes. All of them? Yes. Only they're sitting in the staff barracks and won't go to their own huts. This put the finishing touch to the strike of 3,000 at Ekibastuts, the strike of the traitors. So much for their reluctance to go. In the interrogators' offices, when they were snitching on our friends and signing their perfidious statements, they had hoped that it would all be kept under the seal of the confessional. It had, of course, been that way for decades. A political denunciation was regarded as an unchallengeable document, and the informer's identity was never revealed. But something about our strike, the need perhaps to vindicate themselves in the eyes of their superiors, had compelled our bosses to mount a full-dress trial somewhere in Karaganda. These creatures were taken off one day, and when they looked into each other's anxious eyes, each of them realized that he and all the others were on their way to testify in court. That wouldn't have bothered them, but they knew Gulag's post-war rule. A prisoner called away for some temporary purpose must be returned to his former camp. They were, however, promised that, by way of exception, they would be left in Karaganda. An order was in fact drafted, but incorrectly, not in due form, and Karaganda refused to have them. They were 3 weeks on the road. Their guards herded them from Stolypin cars into transit camps, and from transit camps into Stolypin cars, yelled at them to sit on the ground, searched them, took away their belongings, rushed them into the bathhouse, fed them on herrings and gave them no water. They received the full treatment used to wear down ordinary uncooperative prisoners. Then they were taken under guard into the courtroom, where they faced yet again those whom they had denounced, this time to drive the final nails into their coffins, hang the locks on the doors of their solitary cells, wind back their sentences so that they would have long years to run, after which they were brought home by all those transit prisons and flung, without their masks, into their old camp. They were no longer needed. Informers are like ferrymen. But was not the camp now pacified? Had not nearly 1,000 men been moved out? Could anybody now prevent them from going along to the Godfather's office? Nevertheless, they wouldn't leave the staff building. They were on strike. They refused to enter the camp grounds. Only Kocherova made up his mind to brazen it out in his old role of lover of truth. He went to his team and said, "We don't know why they took us. They took us all over the place and then brought us back." But his daring lasted just one night and one dawn. Next day he fled to the staff room and his friends. So that what had happened had not gone for nothing, and our comrades had not fallen in vain. The atmosphere in the camp would never be as oppressive as before. Meanness was back on its throne, but very precariously. Politics were freely discussed in the huts. No worker signer or foreman would dare kick a Zek or take a swing at him, because everybody knew now how easy it is to make knives and how easily they sink home between the ribs. Our little island had experienced an earthquake and ceased to belong to the archipelago. This was how Ekibastuts felt. It is doubtful whether Karaganda felt the same, and certain that Moscow did not. The special camp system was beginning to collapse in one place after another, but our father and teacher had no inkling of it. It was not, of course, reported to him, and in any case, incapable as he was of giving up anything, he would only have relinquished Katorga on the day his chair burst into flames beneath him. On the contrary, he planned a new great wave of arrests for 1953, perhaps in connection with a new war, and in 1952 expanded the special camp network accordingly. Thus, it was decreed that the Ekibastut's camp should be converted from a division of Steplag, or at times Peschanlag, into the headquarters of a big new special camp complex in the Irtysh Basin, provisionally called Dalag, so that, over and above the numerous slave drivers already there, a whole new administration of parasites arrived in Ekibastut's, and these as well we had to support by our labour. New prisoners, too, were expected any day. Meanwhile, the germ of freedom was spreading. Where, though, could it go from the archipelago? Just as the Dubovka prisoners had once brought it to us, so our comrades now carried it farther. That spring you could see this inscription written, scratched, or chiseled on every lavatory wall in Kazakhstan. Hail to the fighters of Ekibastut's! The first culling of the centre mutineers, about 40 men and the 250 most hardened cases among the big February transport, were taken all the way to Kangir. The settlement was called Kangir and the station Jezkazgan. This was the third Steplag camp division where the Steplag administration and the big-bellied Colonel Chichev in person were to be found. The other Ekibastut's prisoners to be punished were shared between the first and second divisions of Steplag, Rudnik. To warn them off, the 8,000 zeks of Kangir were informed that the new arrivals were bandits. They were marched all the way from the station to Kangir jail's new building in handcuffs. In this way, like a legend in chains, our movement entered still servile Kangir to awaken it, too. Here, as in Ekibastut's a year back, the bully and the informer still reigned supreme. When he had kept our 250 in jail till April, the commander of the Kangir Camp Division, Lieutenant Colonel Fedotov, decided that they had been sufficiently intimidated and gave instructions for them to be taken out to work. The centre had supplied 125 pairs of brand-new nickel-plated handcuffs, latest fascist design, just enough if you handcuffed them two together for 250 prisoners, which was probably how they had determined Kangir's allocation. With one hand free, life is not so bad. Quite a few of the lads in the column had experience of camp jails, and there were also old escapers among them. Tenno, too, was included in the transport, who knew all the peculiarities of handcuffs, and explained to neighbours in the column that with one hand free, there was nothing to getting these cuffs off, with a pin, or even without one. When they got near the working area, the warders began removing handcuffs at several places in the column simultaneously, so as to start the day's work without delay. Whereupon, those who knew how hurriedly took off their own handcuffs and those of other prisoners and hid them under their coats. Another warder took ours off. It never occurred to the warders to count the handcuffs before they let the column pass, and prisoners were never searched on entering their place of work. So that on the very first morning, out of 125 pairs of handcuffs, our lads carried off 23. There, in the work zone, they started by smashing the cuffs with stones and hammers, but soon they had a brighter idea, wrapping them in greased paper so that they would last better, and bricking them up in the walls and foundations of the buildings on which they were working that day, residential block number 20 opposite the Kangir Palace of Culture, together with ideologically uninhibited covering notes. Descendants, these houses were built by Soviet slaves. Here you see the sort of handcuffs they wore. The warders abused and cursed the bandits and produced some rusty old cuffs for the return journey. They were very much on their guard now, but the lads still pinched another six pairs on the way into camp. On each of the two following working days, they stole a few more, and every pair cost 93 rubles. So the bosses of Kangir declined to march the lads about in handcuffs. A man must fight for his rights. At about the beginning of May, they gradually started transferring the Ekibastut's group from the jail to the main camp. The time had come for them to teach the locals a little sense. As a beginning, they mounted a small demonstration. A trustee, barging in at the head of a queue, as was his right, was strangled, not quite fatally. This was enough to start people talking. Things are going to change around here. The new lot aren't like us. It would be untrue to say that in the nest of camps around Jezkazgan, stoolies had never been touched, but this had not become a trend. In 1951, in the jail at Rudnik, prisoners once snatched a warder's keys, unlocked the cell they wanted, and knifed Kozlowskas. Underground centres were now set up in Kengir, one Ukrainian, one all Russian. Knives and masks were made, ready for the chopping, and the whole story began all over again. Voynilovich hanged himself from the bars of his cell. Others killed were the foreman Belokopit and the loyalist Stuli Lifshitz, a member of the Revolutionary Military Committee with the forces facing Dutov during the Civil War. Lifshitz had lived happily in the Rudnik Camp Division, where he was librarian in the Culture and Education section. But his fame had preceded him, and he was knifed the day after his arrival at Kengir. A Hungarian maintenance orderly was hacked to death with axes near the bathhouse. The first to flee and blaze a trail to the safe deposit was Sauer, a former minister in Soviet Estonia. But by now the camp bosses, too, knew what to do. For a long time past there had been walls between the four camp divisions at Kengir. The idea now was to surround each hut with a wall of its own, and 8,000 men started working on it in their spare time. They also partitioned every hut into four sections, with no communication between them. Each miniature camp area and each section was regularly locked. Ideally, of course, they would have liked to divide the whole world into one-man compartments. The sergeant major in charge of the Kengir jail was a professional boxer. He used prisoners as punching bags. In his jail, they had also invented a technique of beating prisoners with mallets through a layer of plywood so as to leave no marks. These practical MVD personnel knew that re-education was impossible without beatings and murders, and any practical public prosecutor would agree. But there was always the danger that some theorist might descend on them. It was this rather improbable visiting theorist who made the interposed plywood necessary. One Western Ukrainian, tortured beyond endurance and afraid that he might betray his friends, hanged himself. Others behaved worse, and both centres were put out of business. What is more, there were among the fighters some greedy rascals interested not in the success of the movement, but in feathering their nests. They wanted extra food brought to them from the kitchen, and a share in other prisoners' food parcels. Among those who take the path of violence, this is probably inevitable. I do not see Kamo's raiders leaving themselves with empty pockets when they paid the proceeds of their bank robberies into party funds. And can we imagine Koba, who directed their operations, leaving himself without money for wine? During the Civil War, when consumption of wine and spirits was prohibited throughout Soviet Russia, he kept a wine cellar in the Kremlin, more or less openly. This helped the authorities to discredit the movement and put a stop to it. Or so they thought. But the Stoolies, too, sang smaller after this first rehearsal. At least the atmosphere in Kengir was cleaner. The seed had been sown, but the crop would be late. And a surprise. We are forever being told that individuals do not mould history, especially when they resist the course of progress. But for a quarter of a century, one such individual twisted our tails as if we were sheep, and we did not even dare to squeal. Now they say that nobody understood. The rear didn't understand. The vanguard didn't understand. Only the oldest of the old guard understood, and they chose to poison themselves in corners, shoot themselves in the privacy of their homes, or end their days as meek pensioners, rather than cry out to us from a public platform. So the lot of the liberator fell upon us little ones, in Ekibastuts, by putting 5,000 pairs of shoulders under those prison vaults and heaving, we had at least caused a crack. Only a little one, perhaps unnoticeable at a distance, and perhaps we had overstrained ourselves. But cracks make caves collapse. There were other disturbances besides ours, besides those in the special camps, but the whole bloody past has been so carefully cleaned up and painted and polished that it is impossible for me now to establish even a bare list of disorders in the camps. I did learn by chance that in 1951, in the Vakhrushevo corrective labour camp on Sakhalin, 500 men were on hunger strike for 5 days, with excitement running high and selective arrests, after 3 runaways had been savagely bayoneted outside the guardhouse. We know of a serious disturbance in Odzellag on September the 8th, 1952, after a man had been killed in the ranks at the guardhouse. Evidently, the Stalinist camp system, particularly in the special camps, was nearing a crisis at the beginning of the 50s. Even in the Almighty One's lifetime, the natives were beginning to tear at their chains. There is no knowing how things would have gone if he had lived, as it was, for reasons which had nothing to do with the laws of economics or society, the sluggish and impure blood suddenly stopped flowing in the senile veins of that undersized and pockmarked individual. According to the Vanguard doctrine, no change should have resulted from this, nor did the Blue Caps fear any change, though they wept outside the main gates on March the 5th. Nor did the men in black jerkins dare to hope for change, though they strummed on their balalaikas. They were not let out of the camp grounds that day. When they discovered that funeral marches were being broadcast and that black-bordered flags had been hung out. Yet some obscure convulsion, some slippage, was started underground. True, the amnesty at the end of March 1953, known to the camps as the Voroshilov Amnesty, was utterly faithful to the spiritual legacy of the deceased, in its tenderness for thieves and its viciousness towards politicals. To curry favour with the underworld, the authors of the amnesty released the thieves upon the land like a plague of rats, leaving ordinary citizens to suffer, to bar their windows and make jails of their homes, and leaving the militia to hunt down all over again all those it had ever caught. Whereas 58s were released in the normal ratio. Of the 3,000 men at No. 2 Camp Division in Kangir, the number set free was 3. An amnesty like this could convince those in Katorga of one thing only, that Stalin's death had changed nothing. No mercy had ever been shown them, and it would not be shown now. If they wanted some sort of life on this earth, they must fight for it. Disturbances in the camps continued in various places in 1953, minor brawls like that in Karlag, Camp Division No. 12, and a major rebellion at Gorlag, Norilsk, about which a separate chapter would now follow, if we had any material at all. But there is none. However, the tyrant did not die in vain. Something hidden from view slipped and shifted, and suddenly, with a tinny clatter like an empty bucket falling, yet another individual came tumbling headlong from the very top of the ladder into the muckiest of bogs. And now everyone, the vanguard, the rear, even the most wretched natives of Gulag, realized that a new age had arrived. To us on the archipelago, Beria's fall was like a thunderclap. He was the supreme patron, the viceroy of the archipelago. MVD officers were perplexed, embarrassed, dismayed. When the news was announced over the radio, they would have liked to stuff this horror back into the loudspeaker, but had instead to lay hands on the portraits of their dear, kind protector, take them down from the walls at Steplak's headquarters. "It's all over now," Colonel Chechev said with quivering lips. But he was mistaken. He thought that they would all be put on trial the very next day. As Kliuchevsky notes, the very day after the emancipation of the gentry, Decree on Rights of the Gentry, February the 18th, 1762, the peasants were also freed, February the 19th, 1861, but after an interval of 99 years. The officers and warders suddenly showed an uncertainty, a bewilderment even, of which the prisoners were keenly aware. The disciplinary officer of Camp Division No. 3 at Kangir, from whom no prisoner had ever received a kind look, suddenly came up to a team from the disciplinary barracks while they were working, sat down, and started offering them cigarettes. He wanted to see what sparks were flying in that turbid atmosphere, and what danger could be expected from them. "What do you say to that, then?" they asked him mockingly. "Was your top boss really an enemy of the people?" "Yes, as it turns out," said the disciplinary officer dolefully. "He was Stalin's right hand, though," said the maliciously grinning prisoners. "So that means even Stalin slipped up, doesn't it?" Yes, said the amiable chatterbox. "Well, lads, it looks as though they'll be letting you out if you're patient." Beria had fallen, and he had bequeathed the blot on his name to his faithful organs, Until then, no prisoner and no free man, if he valued his life, had dared even to think of doubting the crystalline purity of each and every MVD officer. But now it was enough to call one of these reptiles a barrierite, and he was defenseless. In Reschlag, Vorkuta, in June 1953, the great excitement caused by Beria's removal coincided with the arrival of the mutineers transported from Karaganda and Taishet. Most were Western Ukrainians. Vorkuta was still servile and downtrodden, and the newly arrived Zeks astounded the locals with their intransigence and their audacity. And the process that had taken us several long months was completed here in 1 month's time. On July the 22nd, the cement works, building project TTS-2, and pits number 7, number 29, and number 6 struck. The prisoners at these work sites could see each other stopping work, see the wheels and the pit frames coming to a standstill. This time there was no repetition of our mistake at Ekibastutz, no hunger strike. The warders, to a man, immediately fled from the camp grounds, but every day, to yells of, "Hand over the rations, boss man," they trundled provisions up to the fence and shoved them through the gates. I suppose the fall of Beria had made them so conscientious, but for that they would have starved the prisoners out. Strike committees were set up in the camp divisions affected. Revolutionary order was established. The mess hall staff immediately stopped stealing, and although rations were not increased, the food improved noticeably. At pit number 7 they hung out a red flag, and at number 29, on the side facing a nearby railway line, they put up portraits of the Politburo. What could they display, and what could they demand? They demanded that number patches, window bars, and locks be taken off, but touched none of these things themselves. They demanded the right to correspond, the right to receive visits, and a review of their cases. On the first day only, attempts were made to talk the strikers out of it. Then nobody came near for a week, but machine guns were set up on the watchtowers, and the camp divisions on strike were cordoned off. No doubt the brass was scurrying back and forth between Vorkuta and Moscow. It was hard to know what to do in the new circumstances. At the end of that week, General Maslennikov, the head of Reschlag, General Devrenko, and the prosecutor general, Rudenko, started going around the camp with a large suite of officers, as many as 40. Everyone was assembled on the camp parade ground to meet this glittering train. The prisoners sat on the ground while the generals showered abuse on them for sabotage and disgraceful behavior. At the same time, they conceded that some of the demands are well-founded. You can take off your number patches. Orders have been given about the window bars. But the prisoners must return to work at once. The country needs coal. At pit number 7, somebody shouted from the back, "And what we need is freedom, you dirty..." And prisoners began to rise from the ground and disperse, leaving the generals with no audience. According to other accounts, they actually put up this slogan, "Freedom for us, coal for our country." Freedom for us is in itself seditious, of course, so they hastily added, "Coal for our country," by way of apology. At this point, they tore off number patches and began levering out window bars. However, a schism immediately developed, and their spirits fell. "Perhaps we've gone far enough. We shan't get any more out of them," part of the night shift reported, and the whole day shift. The pit wheels started turning again, and the various sites watched each other resume work. Pit 29, however, was behind a hill and could not see the others. It was told that all the rest had started work, but did not believe it, and did not go back. It would obviously have been no trouble to take delegates from pit 29 over to the other pits. But to make such a fuss over prisoners would have been demeaning, and anyway the generals were thirsting for blood. Without blood there's no victory. Without blood these dumb brutes would never learn. On August the 11th, 11 truckloads of soldiers drove up to pit 29. The prisoners were called out onto the parade ground toward the gate. On the other side of the gate was a serried mass of soldiers. "Report for work or we shall take harsh measures." Never mind what measures. Just look at the Tommy guns. There was silence, then the movement of human molecules in the crowd. Why risk your neck, especially if you have a short sentence? Those with a year or two to go pushed their way forward. But there were others who forced a path through the ranks to stand in the front row, link arms, and form a barrier against the strike breakers. The crowd was undecided. An officer tried to break the cordon and was struck with an iron bar. General Derevyanko withdrew to one side and gave the order, "Fire!" on the crowd. There were three volleys, with machine gun fire in between. 66 men were killed. Who were the victims? The front rows, that is to say the most fearless, and also those who had weakened first. This is a law with a wide application. You will even find it expressed in Proverbs. The rest ran away. Guards with clubs and iron bars rushed after the Zeks, beating them and driving them out of camp. Arrests continued for 3 days, August the 1st to the 3rd, in all the camp divisions which had been on strike. But what could be done with those arrested? The organs had lost their cutting edge since the death of their breadwinner. They could not rise to a formal investigation. More special trains, more transfers hither and thither to spread the epidemic more widely. The archipelago was becoming uncomfortably small. For those who were left behind, there was a special punitive regime. A number of thin wooden patches appeared on the roofs of huts at pit number 29, covering the bullet holes made by soldiers firing over the heads of the crowd. Unknown soldiers who refused to become murderers. But there were plenty of others who hit the target. Near the slag heap at pit 29, somebody in Khrushchev's day raised a cross with a tall stem like a telegraph pole on the communal grave. Then it was knocked down, and someone put it up again. I do not know whether it is still standing. Chapter 12. The 40 Days of Kangir. For the special camps, there was yet another side to Beria's fall. By raising their hopes, it confused, distracted, and disarmed the Katorjane. Hopes of speedy change burgeoned, and the prisoners lost their interest in hunting stoolies and sitting in the hole for them in strikes and rebellions. Their anger cooled. Things seemed to be improving anyway, and all they had to do was wait. There was another aspect, too. The epaulettes with blue borders, but without Air Force wings, hitherto the most respected, the least questionable in the armed forces at large, had suddenly become a stigma, not just in the eyes of prisoners or prisoners' relatives, who gives a damn for them, but even perhaps in the eyes of the government. In that fateful year, 1953, MVD officers lost their second wage for their stars, which meant that henceforward they received only one salary, plus increments for length of service, polar allowances, and of course bonuses. This was a great blow to their pockets, but a still greater one to their expectations. Did it mean that they were less needed? The fall of Beria made it urgent for the security ministry to prove its devotion and its usefulness in some signal way. But how? The mutinies, which the security men had hitherto considered a menace, now shone like a beacon of salvation. Let's have more disturbances and disorders, so that measures will have to be taken. Then staffs and salaries will not be reduced. In less than a year, the guards at Kangir opened fire several times on innocent men. There was one incident after another, and it cannot have been unintentional. The camp authorities, of course, acted similarly to speed up events in other places, for instance in Norilsk. They shot Lida, the young girl from the mortar-mixing gang who hung her stockings out to dry near the boundary fence. They winged the old Chinaman. Nobody in Kangir remembered his name, and he spoke hardly any Russian, but everybody knew the waddling figure with a pipe between his teeth and the face of an elderly goblin. A guard called him to a watchtower, tossed a packet of makhorka near the boundary fence, and when the Chinaman reached for it, shot and wounded him. There was a similar incident in which the guard threw some cartridges down from the tower, ordered a prisoner to pick them up, and shot him. Then there was the famous case of the column returning to camp from the ore dressing plant and being fired on with dum-dum bullets, which wounded 16 men. Another couple of dozen concealed light wounds to keep their names out of reports and avoid the risk of punishment. This the Zeks did not take quietly. It was the Ekibastut story over again. Kengir Camp Division No. 3 did not turn out for work 3 days running, but did take food, demanding punishment of the culprits. A commission arrived and persuaded them that the culprits would be prosecuted, as though the Zeks would be invited to the trial to check. They went back to work. But in February 1954, another prisoner was shot at the woodworking plant, the evangelist, as all Kengir remembered him, Alexander Sisoyev, I think his name was. This man had served 9 years and 9 months of his tenor. His job was fluxing arc welding rods, and he did this work in a little shed which stood near the boundary fence. He went out to relieve himself near the shed, and while he was at it, was shot from a watchtower. Guards quickly ran over from the guardhouse and started dragging the dead man into the boundary zone to make it look as though he had trespassed on it. This was too much for the Zeks, who grabbed picks and shovels and drove the murderers away from the murdered man. All this time, near the woodworking plant stood a saddled horse belonging to Security Officer Belyaev, known as the Wart, because he had one on his left cheek. Captain Belyaev was an enterprising sadist, and engineering a murder like this was just his style. The woodworking plant was in an uproar. The prisoners said that they would carry the dead man into camp on their shoulders. The camp officers would not permit it. "Why did you kill him?" shouted the prisoners. The bosses had their explanation ready. The dead man himself was to blame. He had started it by throwing stones at the tower. Can they have had time to read his identity card? Did they know that he had 3 months more to go and was an evangelical Christian? The march back was grim, and there were reminders that the bosses meant business. Machine gunners lay here and there in the snow, ready to shoot. Only too ready, as the men of Kengir had learned. Machine gunners were also posted on the roofs of the escort troops' quarters. This was at the same Camp Division No. 3, which had already seen 16 men wounded at once. Although only one man was killed on this occasion, they felt more painfully than ever that they were defenseless, doomed. Nearly a year had gone by since Stalin's death, but his dogs had not changed. In fact, nothing at all had changed. In the evening after supper, what they did was this. The light would suddenly go out in a section, and someone invisible said from the doorway, "Brothers, how long shall we go on building and taking our wages in bullets? Nobody goes to work tomorrow." The same thing happened in section after section, hut after hut. A note was thrown over the wall to the 2nd Camp Division. They had some experience by now, and had thought about it often enough, so that they were able to call a strike there, too. In the 2nd Camp Division, which was multinational, the majority had tenors, and many were coming to the end of their time, but they joined in just the same. In the morning, the men's camp divisions 2 and 3 did not report for work. This bad habit, striking without refusing the state's bread and slops, was becoming more and more popular with prisoners and less popular with their bosses. They had an idea. Warders and escort troops went unarmed into the striking camp divisions, where two of them at a time took hold of a single Zek and tried shoving and jostling him out of the hut. Far too humane a method. Only thieves deserve to be nannied like this, not enemies of the people. But since Beria's execution, no general or colonel dared take the lead and order machine gunners to fire into a camp. This was wasted labor. The prisoners just went off to the latrines or sloped about the camp ground, anything rather than report for work. They held out like this for 2 days. The simple idea of punishing the guard who had killed the evangelist did not seem at all simple or just to the bosses. Instead, a colonel from Karaganda, with a large retinue, went around the camp on the second night of the strike, confident that he was in no danger, roughly waking everybody up. "How long do you intend to carry on slacking?" Then, knowing nobody there, he pointed at random. "You there, outside! And you, outside!" And these chance people, the valiant and forceful manager of men consigned to jail, imagining that this was the most sensible way to deal with slackers. The Latvian, Will Rosenberg, when he saw this senseless high-handedness, said to the colonel, "I'll go too." "Go on then," the colonel readily agreed. He probably did not even realize that this was a protest, or that there were any grounds for protest. That same night it was announced that the liberal feeding policy was at an end, and that those who did not go out to work would be put on short rations. Camp Division Number 2 went to work in the morning. This book is continued on Cassette 9, Side 1.